This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Through his work as a broadcaster, my guest Tavis Smiley has become an opinion leader, particularly in the African American community. He's a commentator on the nationally syndicated Tom Joyner Morning Show. His Smiley Report is heard daily on urban contemporary radio stations through the ABC radio network. He's a contributor to CNN and formerly hosted his own show on BET. Now he hosts his own national public radio program featuring interviews and commentaries. There's more. He also runs the Tavis Smiley Foundation, whose mission he describes as encouraging, empowering, and enlightening black youth. Smiley started his career as an aide to Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley. In his new book, Keeping the Faith, Smiley collects the comments of African American writers on such themes as black love, faith, inspiration, and grief and healing. He also shares some of his own personal stories, such as coming of age in a trailer with 10 children, including the 4 his parents adopted. Okay, this is what I got to know. What are some of the differences for you doing a show on NPR versus working on commercial radio or cable TV?
Well, one thing you would never hear me say, from National Public Radio, I'm Tavis Smiley. I don't talk that way. My energy level, my vocal quality, my sound, my energy, my flavor, as we like to say in the black community, the flavor that I bring to the program is very different.
Oh, I bring flavor to the show.
Yeah. No, indeed you do, Terry Gross. And so my style is different. So I think stylistically, we have noticed the biggest difference in what I do on commercial radio and what I do on public radio. The other difference is that most of my commercial outlets allow me to express my opinion. I am a commentator, if you will, in most of these commercial outlets. On public radio, I enjoy the opportunity to sit back and to ask the questions because I don't know if this is true or not, Terry. It probably is not. But when I go to bed at night, since hosting a show on NPR, I at least feel smarter. Maybe I am. I don't know. But I certainly feel smarter hosting a show on NPR because I get a chance to ask questions. And I believe ultimately that knowledge is power.
I'm wondering what you think the image of NPR is among your friends, colleagues, and I'm interested in particularly among African American friends and colleagues, if you listened before, if the people you're close to listen, and what the image is, and how you think that compares to the reality.
The reality is that many of my African American friends and colleagues don't know what NPR is, have never heard of NPR. They know the NBA, but they don't know NPR. There are too many people in the African-American community, and for that matter, in communities of color, that do not know what NPR is all about. And the tragedy is that because I believe that information is power, that means there are a lot of people in this country not being empowered through this thing we call National Public Radio. The reality is that it is called National Public Radio, not National One-Third of the Public Radio. And I have been very frank about saying on the air and off the air that public radio, NPR in particular, has to do a better job of using this radio medium to allow Americans to be introduced to each other.
You come from a background of public speaking. Your mother was a minister. She preached at the pulpit. You started in politics before getting involved in broadcasting, so you had to do a lot of public speaking to, like, big gatherings of people. And although on radio or TV you're talking to a lot of people, you're talking to them one-on-one, and it's a very intimate kind of medium compared to speaking in a big hall. I'm wondering if you feel like you had to learn a different style of speaking when you started doing radio.
I am learning a different style, not because of radio as much, but because of public radio and particularly National Public Radio, NPR. In commercial radio, one can obviously get away with a different style. There are shock jocks who scream and yell every day in public radio. I mean, commercial radio, nobody cares, you know, if they're a fan of the show. In public radio, particularly NPR, there is this sound that NPR has that is, I think, at best antithetical to the way that I've approached radio. You know, this real soft National Public Radio kind of thing. And that's not the way I am. That's not my energy level, you know, is significantly higher than that. So within the context of construct of what NPR is, it's something that I work on.
What was your mother's preaching style? Is she still preaching for
She is. My mother is a Pentecostal preacher, charismatic preacher, for those who don't know much about the Pentecostal church. It is, for lack of a better term, high energy. We have a choir. We have in our church, we have a choir, a full choir. We have organ and piano and drums and bass guitar and tambourines. Our church is a high-energy church, and so that's the experience out of which I come. And I think it's reflected in part, you know, by who I am. I grew up in this high-energy church, if you will.
You say you got your sense of faith from your mother and your sense of being hardworking from your father, who was very hardworking. Mm-hmm. What kind of work did he do?
My father was and still is an Air Force officer, 33, 34 years and counting, still in, went in right after high school. So my father's an Air Force officer, so he's served his country honorably for these many years. And when my parents adopted these four kids, and I should say these four kids, I have seven brothers and two sisters. We all part of one big family of 10. But these four persons who were adopted happened to be my cousins. My mother, my mother's sister, my aunt, was murdered back in 1969, 1970. And those four kids were going to be split up and sent to foster homes, different foster homes, because no one family in Mississippi where they were living, we were living in Indiana at the time, no one family where they were in Mississippi could be found to take all four of them in. So rather than split those four kids up, my parents made the decision, even though my father had a meager Air Force salary, to take those four kids in. And we were all raised together. My parents went on to have a few more kids, and so there ended up being a total of 10 of us. And to this day, I have the utmost respect for my parents because of the love that they have shown me how to practice through their own example.
Thinking of how much authority your parents must have had when you were very young, you know, your mother being a preacher is kind of like the voice of God in the mm-hmm. house, and your father being a military officer has a commanding presence, too. I must have been...
You know,
it's hard to get away with anything.
I never quite thought about it in that way, Terry, but that is a very nice way of putting it and a very interesting way of putting it. I have to call my parents when we get out of the studio here and share with them that description. But that makes a lot of sense. My mother was and is the voice of God, small g, of course, in our household, and my father being a military guy. Although it's funny, my father isn't the typical kind of military guy. My father really is very soft-spoken. He's a disciplinarian. He does what has to be done. He puts his foot down, and you do walk in fear and respect of my father's tactics when it comes to discipline. But at the same time, my mother is much more talkative than my father is, and so that was strange in my household. But my father got your respect with just looking at you in a certain way.
I can imagine what that certain way might have been.
Yeah, he didn't have the military voice. It wasn't, soldier, get over here before I, you know, it wasn't like that. But he had that military look, and he still has it down pat.
Now, in your book, Keeping the Faith, you talk a little bit about what happened to you when you and your sister, when you were in seventh grade, mm-hmm. were accused of creating a disruption in church, something that was particularly embarrassing for your mother because mm-hmm. she was very important in mm-hmm. the church. And this was a public accusation. This was, you know, to the whole gathering of the congregation. Your parents were so angry that your father beat you and your sister. What did he do?
We were a part of a family that believed in discipline. Make no mistake about that. You cannot have 10 kids unless the kids are running the household, which was not the case in my family. You have to be very much disciplinarians, and my parents were. And my parents were very spiritual, and it wasn't just my mother who was involved in the church. My father, although not a preacher, was on the board of trustees and a member of the deacon board at my church. So both of them very deeply involved. So it wasn't even just that they were angry. What led to this horrible incident was that my parents were embarrassed. They were embarrassed to have our minister stand up in front of the entire congregation and scold my sister and I. My sister and I were deeply hurt because we had not caused this public disruption. We were accused of something falsely. But my sister and I were severely beaten. My father got home that night. And rather than beating us with a little belt or, you know, a spanking or whatever, that night he was so enraged that he disconnected from one of the kitchen appliances an extension cord. And we were beaten severely with an extension cord so badly that we were hospitalized both for about 10 days each. And to recuperate and to be treated for our condition. My sister and I both still have marks on our bodies to this day from that incident, my sister more so than me. And it was an incident that was clearly one of the defining moments, certainly the defining moment of my young life, because I grew up in a small town in Indiana, and so everybody knew about this. And ultimately, my father was dragged into court. My sister and I were both taken out of the home. We went to live with two different foster families. I eventually returned home to my family. My sister, though, Phyllis, never returned home. And that was traumatic for all of us to just lose a sister overnight.
Was that her choice not to return home?
It was her choice. It was her choice. She went to a different foster family and just decided not to come back. But ultimately, it for me became a source of motivation. I determined, Terry, that I would, as an adult, one day return to that community and didn't want to return in embarrassment. And again, speaking of lessons, I mean, I don't know why I even felt like I had done anything wrong, but I was embarrassed by this entire ordeal. I felt I was shamed by this incident in the community because I think in part because as a kid, you're the one who doesn't get believed. Your side of the story doesn't get told. You're not an adult. Sit in the corner and shut up. And especially when the minister of the church, the reverend, the pastor stands up, then you really have nothing to say and you were wrong and that's the end of it. But it became a source of inspiration and motivation for me. My sister, by contrast, saw her life tank as a result of that. She went on to have a number of kids out of wedlock, became a crack addict. I'm happy to say to this day or at this time, she is doing quite well, not doing drugs, working full time. She's going back to school to get her to college degree. I'm happy to pay for her to do that. So it's turned out, you know, not the worst story, not the worst ending, but it was certainly a traumatic moment in our life.
Here's the paradox with that story. You know, you and your sister ended up being taken away from your parents and put in your foster home. Now, your aunt was murdered when you were a child, and her children, after she was murdered, had no place to go. They first stayed, I think, with your grandmother.
Yes.
When she could no longer take care of them because she became too ill. Rather than watch them go into a foster home, your parents took over their care, and your parents adopted them and brought them up as their children. So here are your parents who have made this tremendous sacrifice in their life to prevent your cousins from having to go to foster homes, and then two of their birth children, you and your sister, are taken from them and put in foster homes. I mean, do you have any sense of how your mother felt about that?
I do. My father, who I love very dearly, and I want to be clear about that, has apologized profusely over the years.
You or to her?
To me and to her. It has been a source of shame and embarrassment for him inside of our family and now, thanks to this book, for everybody else to read. And I worried about that because I didn't want my father's friends these days may not be aware of this that happened 20-plus years ago. I was concerned about my father's welfare and in the telling of this story. My father has apologized profusely. My mother's burden was one of shame based upon not coming into the room to stop what was going on. But my mother, you know, has lived with that for years, and it's very difficult for her to talk about.
My guest is Tavis Smiley. He hosts a new NPR program, and he has a new book called Keeping the Faith. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tavis Smiley is my guest, and he's the host of the Tavis Smiley Show on NPR, and he has a new book now called Keeping the Faith. Now, you've said you inherited your work ethic from your father, who was a military officer and also had a lot of part-time jobs to make ends meet, having to support such a large family. Do you think he liked his work? I mean, you have work that's pretty exciting now, and you're so well-known now. But what about your father? Did he? You saw him working really hard, but did you see somebody who liked working?
I don't know that my father really or necessarily liked what he did, but he went into the Air Force right out of high school, number one. Number two, my father is the kind of person that he's one of those guys that – one of those persons that does what has to be done. It doesn't so much matter that he necessarily likes it. My father had worked a number of odd jobs, as you mentioned. Most of those odd jobs were cleaning up office buildings late nights.
I guess I'm wondering when you started working really hard, whether your vision of work was something that's really awful but had to be done, or whether you really wanted that you could love and looked hard for that.
I went to college and have worked hard and have tried to educate myself because I never wanted to do manual labor. My father, when he got these little contracts to make ends meet cleaning offices, we became his employees, his 10 kids. And so that was never of interest to me. I swore every trash can I had to empty, every toilet I had to clean, I swore this was not the life for me. And I would always tell my younger brothers and sisters, this is what happens when you don't go to college and get a good education. And what did I know about that? I was a kid myself, but I knew there had to be a better way to make a living than what we were doing. So I don't know if my father liked it. I know that Tavis did not like it. And what's funny about this is that my first job out of college, I went to Los Angeles from Indiana University in Bloomington, where I studied, moved to Los Angeles to work for the late, great Mayor Tom Bradley. And my very first job out of college, I made almost twice as much money as my father was making at that time. And it was almost embarrassing. I felt so bad, Terry, almost guilty making that kind of money. Even though I had those dreams as a child, I almost felt guilty making more than my dad, because my dad is the hardest working person I knew. And I felt guilty making more money than my dad.
Now, as a broadcaster, your primary subjects have to do with African-American culture and politics. When you grew up, when you were going to elementary school in the Midwest, you say you went to a predominantly white school. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what impact that you think that had on you, or what it was like then to be one of the few black students in the school?
It was fascinating because it started out, the story has two parts to it. It started out being very challenging for me because I was the only African-American person in mostly all of my classes. It was difficult because I felt like I had something to prove. And they did not understand me or see things the way I saw them. They didn't appreciate the kind of music that I liked. They didn't go to the same kind of church that I went to. I was very, my experiences, my life experiences were very atypical, you know, antithetical to the experiences that, that my classmates had. So on certain levels, we could not relate altogether well. And that caused some problems because I felt like I had to prove myself all the time. And so I started, you know, in the third grade with this chip on my shoulder and, you know, being cantankerous and just difficult to get along with because I was different and they were different and I wanted to be accepted for who I was, but I was going about it the wrong way. Somewhere around the seventh grade, things started to change, things started to happen, and I started to see things a little bit differently.
Was this also a predominantly white school?
My entire career. The entire career. But by the seventh or eighth grade, things started to change a little bit differently. Changed for me in terms of how I related to my classmates. And by the time I got to high school with this same class of white kids, I ended up being elected class president. And all through high school, I was, you know, the black guy, but I was class president, voted most likely to succeed, and won every award you can imagine and all of that good stuff. And I just this past summer returned to Indiana for my 20th high school reunion, was the only black guy in the picture with all of my returning high school classmates. And it's turned out, interestingly, because while I have any number of classmates who've done quite well for themselves, and I don't believe that notoriety or exposure or personality or celebrity makes you better than anybody else, but certainly with regard to achievements, I was the standout at our high school reunion. So it's fascinating how it started out with me being having a very difficult time navigating that color line, if you will. But it all panned out, and I was so excited to go back and to see these people, these white kids I went to school with 20 years ago.
You said that you knew in the high school you were known as the black guy. What did it mean, do you think, to the white students to be the black guy?
I don't know. I know that it meant for me not being treated much differently than anybody else, except for the fact that white girls would not go out with me on dates. I never had a date until I was in college, because I went to an all-white school, and that's where my friends were. And for the prom, I was the class president, but never went to the junior prom. I was class president, but didn't go to the senior prom. I couldn't get a date.
Did you have black friends outside of the school?
Oh, yeah, through my church. I went to a black church. That I did do.
So where it sounds like you were in a mostly white neighborhood. So where was your mother's church?
The church was about 30 miles away from where we lived.
Oh.
So we lived in two different worlds. My daytime world was this white environment. And there are all kinds of black comedians, indeed, those who I feature on my show every Friday, who make jokes about, you know, trailer park trash or white trash in the trailer parks. Well, I grew up in a trailer park. There were 10 kids, my mother, my father, and my maternal grandmother, who we call Big Mama, 13 of us total, in a trailer. I grew up in a trailer, a three-bedroom trailer, with 13 people. My mother and father had one bedroom. Me and my seven brothers had a second bedroom. And my grandmother and my two sisters had the third bedroom.
Did you feel that, you know, living in two different worlds, the daytime world, which was white, or the weekday world, I should say, which was white, and the weekend world. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Which was
More than weekend. We grew up in a – it's a very good question, though. And for those who know anything about the Pentecostal church, they will relate to this, and I'm sure are laughing as we speak. In the Pentecostal church, it's not a weekend thing. It's an everyday thing.
Right.
We had choir rehearsal on Monday night, prayer meeting on Tuesday night, Bible study on Wednesday night, missionary meeting on Thursday night, young people's meeting on Friday night, prayer meeting on Saturday morning, junior choir rehearsal after prayer meeting on Sunday morning, Sunday school at 9:45, morning worship at 11:30, children's church at 5:30, evening service at 7 o'clock, four services on Sunday, and back again on Monday. I did that every day of my life for 18 years.
Tevis Smiley, thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. I appreciate it.
Tevis Smiley's new book is called Keeping the Faith. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.